Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. I want to start off today's episode going big, looking at how happiness and meaning can drive good health. This from The Nation's Health, which is a publication of the American Public Health Association. Happiness can be good for your health. Happiness is more than just a state of mind. It can also be a path to better overall health and well-being. Happiness can be described as feelings of joy and pleasure, or it can mean having a sense of purpose, or maybe it's as simple as having a high sense of satisfaction with your life. Since a large amount of disease is now lifestyle-induced rather than infectious, it would seem that psychosocial well-being is a crucial thing, especially in light of the fact that happy people are typically better at practicing healthy behaviors. So, what makes people happy? It may not be what you think. First up, money. Having money, especially a lot of it, is associated with better health and a longer life. The science is clear on that. However, it's less clear on how much a role money plays in creating happiness. A 2018 study that looked at 1.7 million people around the world found that happiness is associated with a lot less money than what you might think. In general, it found that people making between $60,000 and $75,000 a year are likely to be happy on a day-to-day basis. As income grew beyond levels associated with happiness, life satisfaction actually began to go down. Another myth is that happiness is associated with youth. But again, research has debunked that idea. People get happier as they age. In fact, those over 50 are generally happier than they were during younger years. At the University of California, Berkeley, researchers at the Greater Good Science Center have collected research-based ways to help create happiness. They include walking and enjoying nature, to meditation and expressive writing. Among the tips for inspiring more happiness in your life, take an intentional time out each week for 15 minutes to focus on a positive event in your life and what allowed it to happen. Perform a weekly act of kindness, which can create a greater sense of personal well-being and happiness. Write a letter of gratitude to someone you never thanked and take time to personally deliver it to them. When you're out among people you don't know, strike up a conversation. Find out what interests them and get to know the person. Write down three things that went well for you each day for a week and explain why. Take a walk and notice the positive things around you. Science shows a walk of just 20 minutes can lift your mood. Give up something you love for a period of time, then re-experience the pleasure of it when you begin it again. Pay attention to nature that is around you every day and how it makes you feel. We are not just talking here about the absence of stress, but the presence of enjoyment of life, optimism, and life satisfaction. Well, I'd like to go a lot deeper here because happiness is more than just those positive experiences. It's integrally linked to purpose. And I want to talk. So here's an article from NPR. What's your purpose? Finding a sense of meaning in life is linked to health. Having a purpose in life, whether building guitars or swimming or volunteer work, affects your health, researchers found. It even appeared to be more important for decreasing risk of death than exercising regularly. People who didn't have a strong life purpose, which was defined as, quote, a self-organizing life aim that stimulates goals, end of quote, were more likely to die than those who did, and specifically more likely to die of cardiovascular diseases. Hey folks, you gotta take care of your heart, and it will take care of you. Continuing. People without a strong life purpose were more than twice as likely to die. This association between a low level of purpose in life and death remained true despite how rich or poor participants were, and regardless of gender, race, or education level. The researchers also found the association to be so powerful that having a life purpose appeared to be more important for decreasing risk of death than drinking, smoking, or exercising regularly. Just like people have basic physical needs, like to sleep and eat and drink, they have basic psychological needs, says Alan Rozansky, a professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who is not involved in this research but has studied the relationship between life purpose and physical health. The need for meaning and purpose is number one, Rozansky adds. It's the deepest driver of well-being there is. Woohoo! Well, and being the science freak that I am, I actually dug into the original article that they're reporting on here. This from JAMA Network. Association between life purpose and mortality among U.S. adults older than 50 years. And the thing I found most interesting is it says, our study included a comprehensive analysis of psychological well-being constructs, including four negative psychological measures, depression, anxiety, cynical hostility, and negative affect, and three positive psychological measures, optimism, positive affect, and social participation. It is possible that some or all of these psychological well-being constructs are mediators. So, what did they do? They created two models that adjusted for these seven psychological measures. And what did they find? That the strong relationship between life purpose and mortality still persisted. I think this is important because this leads to an understanding of how deep purpose is and how it's connected to our well-being and our health. Even when you look at things like depression or anxiety or cynical hostility or negative affect or optimism or positive affect or social participation, if you control for all of those things, purpose still has a very powerful, independent effect on our health. This is the going big part of it. It's very easy, like I read off that list about happiness, the things you can do to improve your happiness, and those are all well and fine. But the thing is, without purpose, we're delinking ourselves from basically our life source and something so basic to life that health and well-being cannot flourish or thrive. Okay. And I want to link this to something else that I've been thinking about for a long time, at least these last few years. And this is an article from WeForum. It's a growing number of people think their job is useless. Time to rethink the meaning of work. In a 2013 survey of 12,000 professionals by the Harvard Business Review, half said they felt their job had, quote, no meaning and significance. And an equal number were unable to relate to their company's mission. While another poll among 230,000 employees in 142 different countries showed that only 13% of workers actually like their job. A more recent poll among Brits revealed that as many as 37% think they have a job that is utterly useless. They have what anthropologist David Graeber refers to as BS jobs. On paper, these jobs sound fantastic, and yet there are scores of successful professionals with imposing LinkedIn profiles and impressive salaries who nevertheless go home every evening grumbling that their work serves no purpose. Let's get one thing clear, though. I'm not talking about the sanitation workers, the teachers, and nurses of the world. If these people were to go on strike, we'd have an instant state of emergency on our hands. No, I'm talking about the growing army of consultants, bankers, tax advisors, managers, and others who earn their money in strategic trans-sector peer-to-peer meetings to brainstorm the value add of co-creation in the network society, or something to that effect. It starts with an age-old question. What is the meaning of life? Most people would say the meaning of life is to make the world a little more beautiful or nicer or more interesting. But how? These days, our main answer to that is through work. Our definition of work, however, is incredibly narrow. Only the work that generates money is allowed to count towards GDP. Little wonder, then, that we have organized education around feeding as many people as possible in bite-sized, flexible parcels into the employment establishment. Yet what happens when a growing proportion of people deemed successful by the measure of our knowledge economy say that their work is pointless? That's one of the biggest taboos of our times. Our whole system is finding meaning. Our whole system of finding meaning could dissolve like a puff of smoke. Like Brad Pitt says in Fight Club too often, we're working jobs we hate so we can buy stuff we don't need. And he didn't say stuff. He said another S word. Again, working jobs we hate so we can buy S we don't need. The time has come to stop sidestepping the debate and home in on the real issue. What would our work look like if we were to radically redefine the meaning of work? I firmly believe that a universal basic income is the most effective answer to the dilemma of advancing robotization. Not because robots will take over all the purposeful jobs, but because a basic income would give everybody the chance to do work that is meaningful. I believe in a future where the value of your work is not determined by the size of your paycheck, but by the amount of happiness you spread and the amount of meaning you give. I believe in a future where the point of education is not to prepare you for another useless job, but for a life well lived. I believe in a future where jobs are for robots and life is for people. And if basic income sounds utopian to you, then I'd like to remind you that every milestone of civilization, from the end of slavery to democracy to equal rights for men and women, was once a utopian fantasy too. Or, as Oscar Wilde wrote long ago, progress is the realization of utopias. So as I alluded to, over the last several years, I've really developed a theory that half the work done in the world would be better off left undone. That is, better off if we didn't do it in the first place. And sure enough, this has been bolstered by more recent research. People working in Western civilizations, 37% reporting their job as meaningless. And this actually moves up to about half if you include answering the question. There's like a 50-50 chance that your job is meaningless. And remember, these are not the junk jobs that we usually complain about the most, with low wages, hard, monotonous work. These junk jobs are mostly in addition to this huge proportion of meaningless jobs. Many people spend half or more of their waking hours engaged, or perhaps more appropriately, disengaged with meaningless or junk jobs. I, for one, think we can do better. This is something we need to figure out, or we're going to waft off into a world of work that's meaningless. Riffing a bit on the theme of mental, emotional, and spiritual health, I'd like to talk about a couple of stories on sleep, which is a pillar of health, one of those things that if you're not able to achieve healthy sleep, it's very hard to achieve a good foundation for health. And of course, this is related a lot to stress. You need to have active, engaging, meaningful things during the day, but you need the downtime in order to integrate, rest, recreate, so your life is in balance. Okay, this from Science Daily. School children who nap are happier, excel academically, and have fewer behavioral problems. Ask just about any parent whether napping has benefits, and you'll likely hear a resounding yes, particularly for the child's mood, energy levels, and school performance. A study of nearly 3,000 fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, ages 10 through 12, revealed a connection between midday napping and greater happiness, self-control, and grit, fewer behavioral problems, and higher IQ. The most robust findings were associated with academic achievement. And another one from Science Daily, obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, more prevalent among irregular sleepers. A new study has found that not sticking to a regular bedtime and wake-up schedule and getting different amounts of sleep each night can put a person at higher risk for obesity, high cholesterol, hypertension, high blood sugar, and other metabolic disorders. In fact, for every hour of variability in time to bed and time asleep, a person may have up to a 27% greater chance of experiencing a metabolic abnormality. The prospective results showed that the variations in sleep duration and bedtimes preceded the development of metabolic dysfunction. According to the authors, this provides some evidence supporting a causal link between irregular sleep and metabolic dysfunction. Participants whose sleep duration varied more than 1 hour were more likely to be African Americans, those working non-day shift schedules, those that smoked, and those who have shorter sleep duration. They also have higher depressive symptoms, total caloric intake, and an index of sleep apnea. Increasing sleep duration or bedtime variability was strongly associated with multiple metabolic and simultaneous problems such as lower HDL cholesterol and higher waist circumference, blood pressure, total triglycerides, and fasting glucose. Okay, whoops, I said two. There's actually three. Also, okay, this is from Stat News. Sleeping with a TV on may make you gain weight. Dozing off to late-night TV or sleeping with other lights on may mix up your metabolism and lead to weight gain and even obesity. Daily exposure to light and darkness helps maintain our 24-hour body clock, which regulates metabolism, sleep-promoting hormones, blood pressure, and other bodily functions. Mounting research suggests disrupting that typical sleep-wake cycle may contribute to poor health, increasing risk for high blood pressure, diabetes, depression, and obesity. Those who reported sleeping at night in a room with a television on or a light were more likely to gain at least 11 pounds over about 5 years than those who slept in darkness. They were also about 30% more likely to become obese. Researchers are confident that the added weight wasn't from things like snacking at night, because the analysis accounted for other variables that could have led to weight gain, such as diet, physical activity, and sleep duration. There you go. Moral of the story, get plenty of sleep. Treasure your sleep, my friends. Okay, well, switching gears a little bit, like to observe health observances here at Just for the Health of It. June is Men's Health Month. June is also Gay Pride Month. Woohoo! I think that celebrating Men's Health Month is akin to celebrating Straight Pride Month. Public health and medicine are embodied in patriarchy just like the rest of our culture. And perhaps the only way I will be celebrating Men's Health Month is with this story from The Hill. NIH director will no longer participate in all-male panels. The director of the National Institutes of Health will no longer participate in all-male panels. Francis Collins said in a statement that it is time to end the tradition in science of all-male speaking panels. The decision comes in response to a report by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, which identified a key role for scientific leaders to play in combating gender harassment and disparities in women's visibility in science. Too often, women and members of other groups underrepresented in science are conspicuously missing in the marquee speaking slots at scientific meetings and other high-level conferences, Collins said in a statement. Starting now, when I consider speaking invitations, I will expect a level playing field where scientists of all backgrounds are evaluated fairly for speaking opportunities. If that attention to inclusiveness is not evident in the agenda, I will decline to take part. Collins challenged other scientific leaders to take a similar pledge. Woohoo! Way to go, Francis Collins. Okay, men, the gauntlet is laid down. Use your male privilege to help bring about gender justice. That's how I'll be celebrating Men's Health Week, or Health Month, this month.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, Use of Liminal may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
It's time for the Public Health News and Research Roundup, where I scan public health news and research so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from MedicalExpress.com, three public health interventions could prevent 94 million premature deaths. A worldwide effort to lower people's blood pressure, cut their sodium intake, and eliminate trans fat from their diet could dramatically reduce the incidence of premature death from cardiovascular disease over a quarter century, according to a new study led by the Harvard School of Public Health. They estimated that scaling up treatment of high blood pressure to 70% of the world's population could extend the lives of 39.4 million people. Cutting sodium intake by 30% could stave off another 40 million deaths and could also help decrease high blood pressure death, a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And eliminating trans fats could prevent 14.8 million early deaths. These are realistic goals that have been shown to be attainable on smaller scales. We need the commitment to scale up the programs to achieve them globally. Okay, you might have noticed that this, in three things that you pick out to prevent premature deaths, particularly of heart disease, they pick trans fats, which of course is a health problem. But there's good news in the United States. Basically, trans fats in food manufacturing has been made illegal. It's coming right to the end, and there's a little bit of grandfathering for some things that are being phased out, but pretty much it's been phased out, and we consume way, way less trans fats in the American diet than we did a decade ago or 20 years ago. But that's not necessarily the case worldwide. And of course, we live in a whole world where we should be concerned about one another. Trans fats are basically from partially hydrogenated oils, where chemically you get this funky trans chemical fat rather than the normal biological cis type of fats. So this being cutting this down to basically what the United States and Europe has done worldwide could save 15 million early deaths over the next quarter of a century. And this is something roughly half the scale of ramping up the high blood pressure treatment or cutting the sodium by 30%, both very big things to affect cardiovascular disease. Okay, next up from nutritionfacts.org, what's the secret to Latino longevity? Latinos living in the United States tend to have less education, a higher poverty rate, and worse access to healthcare, and represent the ultimate paradigm of healthcare disparities, with the highest rate of uninsured, lowest rates of health screening and counseling, and poorest levels of blood pressure and blood sugar control, as well as other measures of deficient quality of care. So they must have a dismal public health statistics, right? Well, according to the latest national data, the life expectancy of white men and women is 76 and 81 years, respectively, and that of black men and women is shorter by a handful of years. And Latinos? Amazingly, they beat out everyone. Latinos live the longest. This has been called the Hispanic paradox. Latinos have a 24% lower risk of premature death and lower risk of 9 of the leading 15 causes of death, with notably less cancer and heart disease. This was first noticed 30 years ago, but was understandably met with great criticism. Maybe the data were unreliable. No, that didn't seem to be it. Maybe only the healthiest people migrate. Turns out the opposite may be true. What about the salmon bias theory, which proposes that Latinos return to their home country to, quote, die in their home so they aren't counted in U.S. death statistics? That theory didn't pan out either. Systematic reviews confirm the existence of a Hispanic paradox. Given the strong evidence, it may be time to accept it and move on to figuring out the cause. The very existence of the Hispanic paradox could represent a major opportunity to identify a protective factor for cardiovascular disease applicable to the rest of the population. After all, whatever is going on is strong enough to overcome the disadvantageous effect of poverty, language barriers, and low levels of education, health literacy, quality of health care, and insurance coverage. Before we get our hopes up too much, though, could it just be genetic? No. As foreign-born Latinos acculturate to the United States, as they embrace the American way of life, their mortality rates go up. So, what positive health behaviors may account for Latino longevity? Perhaps they exercise more. No, Latinos appear to be even more sedentary. They do smoke less, however, the paradox persists even after taking that into account. Could it be their diet? As they acculturate, they start eating more processed and animal-based foods and consume fewer plant foods, and perhaps one plant food in particular, beans. Maybe a reason Latinos live longer is because they eat more beans. Although Latinos only represent about 10% of the population, they eat a third of the beans in the United States, individually eating 4 to 5 times more beans per capita, a few pounds a month as opposed to a few pounds per year. This may help explain the Hispanic paradox, because legumes, beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils cool down systemic inflammation. You can see this mechanism researchers propose in terms of lung health. While cigarette smoking and air pollution cause lung inflammation, which increases the risk for emphysema and lung cancer, when we eat beans, the good bacteria in our gut take the fiber and resistant starch and form small-chain fatty acids that are absorbed back into our system and decrease systemic inflammation, which not only may inhibit lung cancer development, but also other cancers throughout the body. Latinos had the lowest rate of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or emphysema, and lung cancer. They also tend to have lower rates of bladder cancer, throat cancer, and colorectal cancer for both men and women. The systemic inflammation concept is also supported by the fact that while Latinos do get cardiovascular disease or lung, colon, or breast cancer, they have improved survival rates. Decreasing whole body inflammation may be important for both prevention and survival. Asian Americans also appear to have some protection, which may be because they eat more beans too, particularly in the form of tofu and other soy foods, as soy intake is associated with both preventing lung cancer and surviving it. Hispanics also eat more corn, tomatoes, and chili peppers. A quarter of the diet in Mexico is made up of corn tortillas. And Mexican Americans, whether born in Mexico or the United States, continue to eat more than the general population. Looking at cancer rates around the world, not only was bean consumption associated with less colon, breast, and prostate cancer, but consumption of rice and corn appeared protectively correlated too. Since NAFTA, though, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Mexican diet has changed to incorporate more soda and processed and animal foods, and their obesity rates are fast catching up to those in the United States. In the United States, Latinos eat more fruits and vegetables than other groups, about 6 or 7 servings a day. Yes, Hispanics may only have half the odds of dying from heart disease, but it's still the number one cause of death among Hispanics. Therefore, the current results should not be misinterpreted to mean that cardiovascular disease is rare among Hispanics. Ideally, they'd be eating even more whole plant foods, but one thing everyone can learn from the Latino experience is that a shift towards a more plant-based diet in general can be a potent tool in the treatment and prevention of chronic disease. Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. If I were to boil down my nutrition advice into 2 words, it would be this, beans and greens. Beans, when you look at the global burden of disease among populations around the world, the one thing that's most associated with a variance and is positive is actually legume or bean consumption. Okay, switch gears a little bit here. Poll. 1 in 4 Americans say costs led to skipping medical care, from thehill.com. 27% of adults say they or a member of their household have avoided necessary medical care in the past 2 years because of cost. In addition, 45% of the public says it is difficult to pay their deductibles and other out-of-pocket health care expenses. The poll finds that 20% of adults say they have thought about getting a new job or starting a business in the past 10 years, but did not pursue it because of the need to maintain their health coverage. I think this last thing is one of the things that's really overlooked when you're looking at the possibilities of like universal health coverage or Medicare for All or the like, because of its interesting link to both entrepreneurial activity and the mobility of labor. Because people don't necessarily have the portability of their health insurance, the particular type of health insurance they have, or in starting a business, you won't necessarily have easy access in the transition. It can really cut down on entrepreneurial activity. Okay, in a related story, a longer one, that gets to a lot of interesting things around cost and its effect on our quality of healthcare and health. This from the LA Times. Soaring health insurance deductibles and high drug prices hit sick Americans with a double whammy. The steep rise in health insurance deductibles over the last decade has saddled and insured middle and working class Americans with medical bills they can't afford, an LA Times examination of job-based insurance shows. As drug prices have skyrocketed and deductibles in job-based coverage have more than tripled in the last 12 years, soaring to an annual average of $1,350, these sick Americans now routinely pay thousands of dollars every year to get care they need. This has made being sick in the U.S. dramatically more expensive. The financial strain is pushing millions of seriously ill Americans to ration their care, jeopardizing their health and even their lives. In 2016, for example, Americans taking multiple sclerosis medications every month paid on average $3,708 a year out of pocket for the drugs. Patients in high deductible health plans paid even more, with an average annual cost of nearly $8,000. 15 years early, the out-of-pocket costs for those same medications were $244 on average, adjusted for inflation. Analyzing bankruptcy records and cancer registries in Washington State, Ramsey found that cancer patients were more than 2.5 times more likely to declare bankruptcy than people without the disease, even after accounting for differences in age, socioeconomic status, and other factors. Several Western European countries, including Britain and France, which have national healthcare systems, limit cost sharing for people with some chronic conditions, making prescription drugs available at no cost to patients. Holland, which relies on private insurance, requires insurers to exempt primary healthcare visits from any cost sharing. In the U.S., however, federal law generally prohibits high deductible plans from exempting these services, forcing patients to pay for them in full until they meet their deductibles. "What we're doing makes no sense," says David Grabowski, a health policy researcher at Harvard Medical School. "We want these people to take their medications. That's not only good for their health, it's good for overall healthcare spending," he said. "This is a penny wise and pound foolish." 1 in 8 covered workers in a household where someone is chronically ill reported having declared bankruptcy because of medical bills. "There are drugs that we know work," he said, "but patients aren't taking them. Half of all Americans in a job-based health plan say they or an immediate family member have delayed a doctor's appointment, not filled a prescription, or postponed some other medical care in the last year because of cost. Among people with a serious medical condition, that rises to 6 in 10. Among covered workers in plans with at least a $3,000 individual or $5,000 family deductible, it's 3/4. Across the board, people in high deductible plans are using less care," said William Johnson, the report's lead author. "When you shift costs onto patients, they respond. It's a very powerful incentive. Tracking patients for many years to figure out how rationing affects health is difficult, but researchers are beginning to find signs of a toll. In one recent study, low-income workers and their family members with diabetes sought nearly 22% more emergency care for avoidable complications after they switched to a high-deductible plan. Other research indicates that the financial strains may shorten patients' lives. In addition to discovering higher bankruptcy rates among cancer patients, Ramsey, the Washington researcher, found that people with certain common cancers who did go bankrupt died sooner than similar cancer patients who did not. Please note, that this article really focuses on employer-based and private insurance, where high deductibles and high copays and increased premium sharing and costs hits patients the hardest. This is why moving to something like Medicare for All would actually get rid of actually the worst coverage, which is actually private coverage as a whole. Okay, well, that's enough for our show here today. We've run out of time. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@topun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.